Did you have breakfast today? If you didn't, is it because you're doing intermittent fasting? I wouldn't be surprised because more and more people I know are restricting their eating times, hoping to gain health benefits, lose weight, or live longer. But it's actually more than a fad. The practice has a long history and a lot of new science supporting it. But before trying fasting for yourself, it'd be smart to consult with your doctor, get some expert advice, and have a listen to this summary of the new book, The Oldest Cure in the World, Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting by Steve Hendricks. Steve is a freelance journalist who writes for outlets like Harper's and Outside Magazine, and his book presents the latest research alongside history and a bit of self-experimentation. Here's Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve Hendricks, author of The Oldest Cure in the World, Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting. I've been writing about fasting for publications like Harper's Magazine for the last 10 years. And in that time, the counterintuitive science of not eating for health has blossomed in the most extraordinary way. We humans have fasted for the whole of our existence. But only in the last two centuries did a vanguard of doctors and scientists finally begin to unlock fasting's secrets and demonstrate fasting's power to make us healthier. Unfortunately, the evidence they offered was flatly rejected by the medical and scientific establishments. Until now. Today, a mass of evidence has proven that fasting can not only protect us from diseases we don't yet have, but can reverse an astonishing range of diseases we do have. Here are five insights about fasting for health that I learned while researching The Oldest Cure in the World. Insight number one is that when we fast, our bodies heal. Our bodies are marvelous self-healing machines. Every hour of every day, they repair and replace cellular parts gone wrong, patching up damaged or miscopied DNA, or recycling worn-out organelles, which, if not taken care of, might turn into disease. The trouble is, these repairs mostly occur at a very low rate, because the body is so busy doing all the other things that make up our lives, including the immense tasks of digesting our meals, processing the nutrients from those meals, and putting the nutrients to work in cells all over the body. But when we stop eating for long enough, the body takes advantage of the break from all that heavy work, and our cells, in a wonder of evolution, use the downtime to supercharge their repairs. These profound repairs protect us from disease and might even help us live longer. Insight number two, we fast every night. Making that fast longer makes us healthier. See, our bodies make most of their daily repairs after we've stopped eating. But it's a lot of work for the body to switch from its daytime mode of digesting and processing nutrients to its nighttime mode of making repairs. So the body doesn't start its repairs in earnest until it's absolutely sure we're done eating. About 6 hours after our last calories, the repairs start, and they slowly ratchet up, hour by hour, until they reach a kind of repair overdrive after another 6 hours, which is to say, 12 hours after our last calories. Unfortunately, studies show that most of us are eating or drinking something caloric across 14 or 15 hours a day, which means we're fasting just 9 or 10 hours a night. Since the repairs don't start until 6 hours into our fast, most of us are getting only 3 or 4 hours a night of repairs, and we're never reaching repair overdrive at 12 hours. But we can change that. If we eat, for example, in an 8-hour window and fast the other 16 hours, we'll get 10 hours of substantial repairs, 4 of those hours in overdrive. The benefits of eating in a narrowed window are impressive. In one trial, after a mere 4 days of eating in a 6-hour window, volunteers saw a 22% leap in their autophagy, which is the vital recycling of damaged and worn-out cellular parts. Think of that. Just 4 days of changing not what they ate, but when they ate, improved this longevity marker by nearly a quarter. The science of time-restricted eating, as the practice is known, is still evolving. But the best data we have suggests that our health starts to improve with an eating window of 12 hours, and the benefits grow with each hour we shave off that 12 down to about 6 hours. The third insight is that the adage, eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper, is good advice. A lot of people who narrow their eating window do so by skipping breakfast and eating from, say, noon to 6 p.m. That was certainly the way I used to do it. But new science shows it's far healthier to eat in an earlier window, one that opens about an hour or two after you wake up and closes 6 hours later. That 22% boost in cellular recycling I just mentioned, it came from eating in a window that ran from roughly 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Windows that start later haven't produced health benefits nearly as impressive. Eating more of our food earlier is healthier because our circadian rhythms have hardwired us to digest and process nutrients most efficiently in the morning and early afternoon. The longer the evening goes on, the worse we do with nutrients. To take just one aspect of this metabolic slowdown, each afternoon our bodies start shutting down the production of the hormone insulin, whose job it is to move glucose, which is the sugar from our meals, out of our arteries and into the cells that will use the sugar for fuel. When we eat in the late afternoon or at night, there's less insulin in our bloodstream, so the glucose lingers longer in our arteries where it dings up the arterial walls. Over time, the arteries can harden, putting us at risk of heart attacks, strokes, dementia, and other calamities. To make matters worse, eating late also interrupts the overnight repairs that might fix some of that damage. The penalties of eating late may take years to emerge, but when they do, they can be gruesome. This circadian rhythm of nutrient processing is so potent that you can feed pre-diabetics the same meal at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m., and although their blood sugar will hardly rise after the morning meal, after the evening meal, the sugar lingers so long in their blood that some of them will test fully diabetic. In similar tests, many healthy people will test pre-diabetic after a late meal. Evidently, we just weren't made to process nutrients at night. This point was made brutally clear in a study of 15,000 attempted suicides in Sri Lanka, where the preferred method is pesticide. The study found that those who poisoned themselves in the evening died only half as often as those who poisoned themselves in the morning. That's because in the morning, the victim's digestive tracts quickly absorbed the pesticide and shuttled it efficiently throughout their bodies, so by the time they were found and rushed to a hospital, they were usually beyond saving. In evening suicide attempts, however, the poison moved much more slowly through their bodies, and the victims could often be saved. These and many other studies convinced me, but I had long been a breakfast skipper and a lover of late dinners, and I hated the idea of eating in an early window. But when I reluctantly made an experiment of eating between 8:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. each day, I was surprised to find that after just a couple of days, my body easily adapted to the switch, as if it had been waiting for me to do it all these years. I had more energy, my longtime food cravings diminished, and in the end, it proved to be one of the easiest big changes I've ever made. After doing it for a couple of years now, you couldn't pay me to go back to the way I ate before. Not all of us, of course, can or want to eat in an early window. And for those people, there may be a compromise. Scientists think that stacking most of your calories at breakfast and lunch and eating a light dinner, breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper, will probably give you many of the benefits of eating in a narrower early window. Insight number four is that prolonged fasting can reverse cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and many other devastating illnesses. In fact, long fasts can reverse such an unbelievably wide range of disease that until recently, people who spoke of these reversals were simply written off as fools or quacks. And yet we now have 2 centuries of credible reports from fasting doctors in America and Europe, with growing corroboration from peer-reviewed research that strongly suggest fasting for days or weeks can partially or completely reverse diseases like arthritis and gout, asthma and bronchitis, allergies, migraine, schizophrenia, stubborn skin diseases like psoriasis and eczema, enlarged prostate and impotence, fibromyalgia, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and ulcerative colitis, and dozens of other illnesses. The reason prolonged fasting can reverse such a variety of diseases is that the intense repairs that fasting triggers take place in almost every kind of cell, in virtually every part of the body. The healing is systemic, not limited to one organ or to one type of cell. This is particularly good news for sufferers of some of our deadliest diseases. Type 2 diabetes, for instance, afflicts 10% of Americans, and many doctors still say it can't be cured. In fact, a French-Italian doctor first cured diabetes through fasting a century ago, and reported his discovery at scientific conferences, only to have it brushed aside when insulin was developed. More recently, America's oldest and largest fasting clinic, the True North Health Center in California, has estimated that approximately 80% of the type 2 diabetics who have fasted under their care over the last four decades have achieved remission. Fasting is also tremendously successful at reversing high blood pressure, a leading manifestation of cardiovascular disease, our number one killer. Virtually everyone with high blood pressure who undertakes a prolonged fast enjoys a hefty drop in their pressure. In fact, the largest therapeutic drop ever reported in the peer-reviewed literature came not from a pill or a procedure, but from roughly 10 days of medically supervised fasting. In that study, which was published two decades ago, the average drop in blood pressure was an astounding 37 over 13 points, and the sickest patients, the ones with stage 3 hypertension, got the biggest drop, a whopping 60-point decline in their systolic pressure, the top number in a blood pressure reading. Unfortunately, the American Heart Association still says, quote, high blood pressure cannot be cured, and tells the 50% of American adults who have the disease to talk to their doctors about drugs, which have to be taken for life and sometimes have harsh side effects. I look forward to the day when the Heart Association suggests we ask our doctors about fasting. The fifth insight is that fasting can even fight cancer and can make chemotherapy and radiation less awful. Prolonged fasting can slow the growth of many cancers, partly because fasting starves them of their preferred fuel, glucose, and partly because fasting tamps down the growth factors that cancer hijacks to divide and spread. Peer-reviewed case studies have even reported that fasting has completely eliminated one cancer in humans, follicular lymphoma, which attacks the lymphatic system and which till now has been deemed incurable. Fasting hasn't been shown to eliminate other cancers in humans, because cancer is pretty good at finding ways around the hurdles that fasting throws up. Even so, some of the most exciting research today uses those hurdles to make chemotherapy and radiation more potent against cancer and less horrific to the patient. Scientists have learned that when cancer patients fast for just a few days, their healthy cells go into a protect and repair mode, hunkering down and licking their wounds. So when cancer patients fast and then get chemo or radiation, their healthy cells do a better job at repelling the devastating treatments and aren't as badly hurt. They also do a better job at quickly fixing whatever damage they do suffer. The result for chemo and radiation patients is far less nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, fewer headaches, and less fatigue. Meanwhile, during the fast, their cancer cells pay no attention to the absence of food and keep gobbling up any and all inputs, including chemo and radiation. Because the fast may have weakened the cancer, the chemo and radiation may kill more of the cancer cells. And that's not all. With the healthy cells better protected and the cancer cells more vulnerable, doctors should be able to give higher doses of the chemo or radiation to kill even more cancer without killing the patient. That, at least, is what happens in mice, and very promising trials are underway to see if the same holds true for humans. The future for the science and practice of fasting has never been more radiant. It was an exciting topic to research and write about, and I hope it makes for a compelling read.
Thank you, Steve. That was Steve Hendricks with five big ideas from The Oldest Cure in the World, Adventures in the Art and Science of Fasting. If you want to hear another perspective, check out our book bite for Anxious Eaters, Why We Fall for Fad Diets. It's here in the app. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go get something to eat.